So the title might be a bit strange, but I wanted to make it clear that I was making no claim to cover the entire field or anything like that. So yes, we have a lot of pulsars on campus. I should talk a bit first. So this is actually the work of several different people, and a lot of it is actually from the thesis work of Adam Chandler, who is eminently, he's just submitted his thesis. And also Don Backer at Berkeley has been an important part of this project, and Stuart Anderson and Sri Kulkarni at Caltech. So I knew that since I was the third pulsar speaker today, that Scott and Fernando would cover a lot of the basic things that everyone needs to know about, so I knew that I would just be boring you to go over those same things again. And just recently I realized that I have a 20-minute talk and not a 15-minute talk as I had remembered. So I thought I'd put in some other things that you might not be quite as interested in, but hopefully it'll give you a little bit better of an idea of what the selection effects are for discovering various kinds of pulsars and globular clusters. So the pulsars that I'm going to be talking about come exclusively from a search project using the new Green Bank Telescope. So the goal is, you know, we have this new sensitive instrument that can see further south than Arecibo, even though it's further north. And so we can look at some clusters near the center of the galaxy in the bulge that haven't been studied with such a sensitive instrument before. So we installed the BCPM, as Scott mentioned, and ironically, Scott's been the only person, I think, to have the luxury of using both BCPMs at the same time. So we've had to make do with just one. But it's a 96-channel digital filter bank, and that plays into some of the selection effects that hopefully I'll talk about just a bit later. We've observed 7 globular clusters for roughly 6 hours each. Although the data analysis is by no means complete on all 7 clusters. And also, Adam Chandler developed a search technique for finding accelerated binary pulsars, which is a little bit different and fills a different niche than some of the things that Scott's talked about. So I'll tell you a little bit about that, and that will, if nothing else, illuminate a bit more of the selection effects, as I said. So before I start into this, basically there are three main types of search techniques for finding pulsars whose pulse period is changing throughout your observation. The oldest one that's been around for several years is just a standard acceleration search, which basically means you assume that the pulsar has a constant acceleration throughout the observation. Well, that's great if the observation length is a lot smaller than the orbital period, but this assumption breaks down otherwise. And then Scott has developed this really elegant technique that he talked about a little bit, for finding pulsars whose orbital period is much less than the observation length. And because clusters are far away, you need long observations. So this is a really important area of parameter space to probe. It's nice if you're looking for nearby disk pulsars, because you observe for a few minutes, you see it, and unless the orbital period is ridiculously small, it's not a big problem. But this technique that Adam developed is based on dividing the observation into several small chunks and computing a power spectrum of each. And the number of chunks that you divide it into depends on assumptions about orbital period, so you do this for several different trials since you don't know the orbital period. Then in each power spectrum, you find bins which have locally significant excess power. Now, this is a much lower bar than saying this is a globally significant pulsar candidate, because if all you were doing was looking for these locally significant power excesses, you would have so many candidates it would just be useless. But the next step, then, you have all these candidates and it's useless, but then you look at the adjacent chunks of power spectrum and say, okay, if I want to restrict myself to accelerations in this range, the pulsar period could have changed by a given amount from one sub-integration to the next one, which might be, you know, 1,000 seconds later. And so you can look for other locally significant bins in your power spectrum within this range of changes of spin frequency. And this allows candidates to be identified even when in one relatively short integration there's nothing significant there. But when you take the entire set of these sub-integration power spectra together, it can become very significant. And as I said, this is this is a good technique to use when the orbital period of the as yet undiscovered pulsar is comparable to the observation length. So here just
different from averaging the power spectra, because you would also see a growing power near the frequency.
Right, that's
kind of averaging them then.
I think if you average them, the
keep going.
Okay. So here is an example which is actually a simulation of a pulsar, a millisecond pulsar in an orbit which has a comparable period to the observation length. And as I said, part of this is just to give the non-pulsar people, which is most of you in the audience, a feel for how these things look. So here is the pulsar's spin frequency changing as a function of the time throughout the orbit. This is a roughly 10,000 second simulated observation. And you can see that in most, if not all, of these time slices, the brightest the spin frequency of the pulsar, you know, doesn't really look like all that much compared to other things that you're seeing just in a small chunk of the power spectrum. And if you took the entire power spectrum, there would be noise peaks that would be larger than this. And especially if you throw in data from a real telescope which has airport radar and airplanes flying around and cell phones and microwaves, it becomes a real mess. I think if you took this and just just stacked this whole thing, the sensitivity would go down by a lot because the signal to noise in each bin would be, you'd be averaging that down. Although I haven't looked at that analytically. And then this is actually a real observation of the neutron star binary M15C from real Arecibo data. So this is an 8-hour orbital period. And the point here is just that this technique works well for eccentric binaries too. I hope you can see this. There are these dotted lines, and those indicate the range of accelerations that are being allowed in this given search trial. So you would since you don't know what the pulsar's parameters are that you're looking for, you will do iterations of this search technique with different size. Breaking the data up into different size chunks. You don't want to make them smaller than you need to because that hurts your sensitivity. And different angles of these lines correspond to different ranges of accelerations that you're allowing from one sub-integration to the next. So this is a new technique, and in terms of applicability, this is a simulation of a one-hour binary system. This dotted line is sort of the theoretical perfect sensitivity curve, which would result if you employed some technique which perfectly corrected for the binary motion. So in other words, there's no smearing. There's no unaccounted for change in the spin frequency throughout the observation. Up here in the short observation compared to binary period regime, we have the sensitivity of, there are some different assumptions that go in, which is why we beat what I call the perfect sensitivity. This is the standard constant acceleration search technique. Over here at the long observation compared to orbital period, here is Scott's sideband search technique, which is, it's very good for these long, for short period binaries. But then there's this broad range in the middle where this dynamic power spectrum technique could have a lot of value. Just a quick talk about, well, not really a talk about the pulsar population, but this is a period and magnetic field diagram for all known pulsars and some that I'm not sure are really real. And the dotted line, or the dashed line, is the so-called spin-up line, which means if you recycle a pulsar with a given magnetic field, you can get it to spin as fast as this line indicates, but no faster. So you don't want to see recycled pulsars to the left of this line. Well, the red pulse, the red points are globular cluster pulsars, and you see that right down here we have these two, which spin faster than they can. But these are both examples of contamination of the observed period derivative by acceleration in the cluster potential. But what I would like you to notice, or maybe to believe me about, because you probably can't see it, is if you look at here's 200 milliseconds. Well, there are only three points on this plot, three red points to the right of 200 milliseconds. So there are very few slow pulsars known in globular clusters. So now to some search results. So we found three additional pulsars in M62, NGC 6266, in addition to the three which were discovered at Parkes. And these are just the pulse profiles of the three. These are all millisecond pulsars with spin periods of just a couple of milliseconds. And they look like usual kinds of millisecond pulsars. As yet another illustration of what real search data looks like, here you can see the spin frequency changing. This is M62D, and it's a relatively long period binary, about 1.2 days. So the change in spin period or spin frequency over the observation isn't that extreme, but pulsar E, we see basically an entire pulse period in one orbit. And also there's a hint of an eclipse here, which I'll mention in a moment. So here are the six pulsars, all in one place that I think Fred asked about. So the orbital periods range from a couple of hours up to 4 days, and the these are all low mass companions, and all spin periods of just a couple of milliseconds. So this is a fairly homogeneous population, kind of like 47 Tuck, except that these are all binaries. So we would expect at some point to start seeing some isolated pulsars, if things are as they are in most clusters. One thing there, it's been observed by Paulo Freire and Fernando contributed to this work as well, I think, that with these very low mass cluster low-mass companion cluster pulsar systems, if the minimum companion mass is about 0.3 solar masses, typically you see eclipses, and if it's less than that, you don't. And so the idea is that these are all sort of the same systems, and you're seeing them at different inclinations, and if you're looking at them sort of face-on, then the minimum companion mass is smaller, and you don't see the eclipse. And so as I pointed out, pulsar E, there's an eclipse that you can see in the dynamic power spectrum plot, and it has a companion mass of about 0.03. I think these are all I don't know exactly what they are, but you know the usual. Yeah, I think so. Fernando, do you know if that's right? They're circular enough that I didn't really pay attention. Just an idea of our sensitivity, things, because we're limited at the moment to this 96-channel filter bank, we're sort of stuck with a compromise between sensitivity, which you get from large bandwidths, and time resolution, which you get from small bandwidths because of dispersion smearing. And in way of selection effects, this is a problem here. In the near future, and I would have expected in the recent past, but not, there will be a much enhanced pulsar search machine at Green Bank, which will give thousands of channels instead of 96 across our band. And so that will really be a powerful search instrument, and I think that's the kind of enhancement that could really lead to finding those other pulsars that Fernando believes, and I believe too, should be in M62. So that'll be an exciting development. As you can see, our observations are somewhat, but not shockingly, more sensitive than previous work from Parkes. And these are the fluxes, which are pretty rough, and periods of the six pulsars plotted here. And I should point out that, at least for DE and F, these are really discovery fluxes and not average fluxes. I hope to present the full timing solutions with positions and all of the related stuff that the fun science comes out of for these pulsars, but unfortunately I wasn't able to successfully complete that in time for the meeting. So those results are newish, but not really that new. The new results are there's a new millisecond pulsar, an isolated pulsar in NGC 6544 with a period of about 4 milliseconds. We see the pulse profile. This is pulse profile grayscale as a function of observing time, so you can see that it's there the whole time, which is a good clue that it's a real pulsar. This is sort of hard to see, but the dispersive delay, you can see the pulse arrival as a function of frequency is wrapping like this. So it wraps many pulse periods across our observing bandwidth. And the spin frequency doesn't really change as a function of time. So these are the two pulsars that exist in this cluster. One of them is the shortest period binary radio pulsar with a orbital period of about an hour and a half. And now there's this second similar spin period but isolated pulsar. Okay, so now I think this may be the, if this were a talk about non-globular cluster pulsars, this would definitely be the most boring part, but I think it's perhaps the most interesting part of this talk. So we've found a new slow pulsar in NGC 6624 with a spin period of about 406 milliseconds. These two pulsars, by the way, were just confirmed about a week ago, so this is fairly hot off the press. So now this is, this cluster is fairly anomalous. It has three pulsars. None of them are binary, and two of them are slow. And this cluster also contains the LMXB with the shortest orbital period of about 11 minutes. So, and here are the three pulse profiles. This is the millisecond pulsar. This is the previously known slow pulsar, and this is the pulse profile of our new slow pulsar. And these are from about a six-hour observation, all of them. Okay, so I don't have a lot of insight in this, but I'll at least motivate discussion a little bit. So there are only four cluster pulsars, and maybe, including this new one, and maybe only three of them are real associations with periods greater than 200 milliseconds. If you drop that to 100 milliseconds, it only goes up by two. So I haven't selected the cutoff to make it seem more interesting than it is. And two of them are in one cluster. So where could these come from? Well, you could have accretion-induced collapse of a white dwarf that accretes a little bit of matter. An old white dwarf accretes some matter, becomes a pulsar. Or you could have an old pulsar that lived its life in the cluster, faded away, but then recently, because of an interaction, captured a new companion and accreted some material, was mildly recycled, came back to life as a mildly recycled pulsar. But in both of these scenarios, you expect to see a companion. And at least two of these three previously known pulsars have characteristic ages of only about 10 to the 7 years. And so it's a little bit hard to get rid of a companion so reliably in such a short time. Now, NGC 6624A has a characteristic age about an order of magnitude larger. But still, as a group, it's a little bit disturbing that you don't see a companion. I should point out it's not universally true that these don't have companions, but these two don't. And of course, we don't know what the characteristic age of NGC 6624C is yet. Perhaps a more likely scenario is that an old neutron star actually collides with a non-degenerate star, and there's an accretion, a common envelope phase, an accretion disk, some mild recycling, and you end up with a slightly spun up reborn pulsar with no companion. But like I said, this is not new or I'm just motivating discussion, and yes, I already said that. Okay. So what do we expect to see out of this program in the near future? Very soon I hope to complete the timing solutions for the M62 pulsars and start being able to do real science with them. Hopefully find some pulsars in the remaining clusters. And that's it. Thank you.
So you mentioned accretion-induced collapse, and the problem is then what happened to the companion since the system seems to be so young. But the likely global cluster version of accretion-induced collapse is not accretion from the companion that induces the collapse. It's the thing that more and more people are talking about. Jared Hurdley showed from his simulations very clearly that this is expected to occur at high rates in global clusters. It's the version where you have a merger between two white dwarfs that gives you a single object above the chain of Sekar mass. And so it's not accretion-induced collapse, it's kind of merger-induced collapse. It's the same basic idea, and of course you can wave your hands in the same way about how that forms a millisecond pulsar. But that certainly gets rid of the companion problem.
So I just had a question on the technique, Adam Chandler's dynamic mm-hmm. power spectrum technique. So when in those plots where you have sort of the peak moving around with the orbital with the orbit,
right?
Is there some automated scheme for recognizing that, or does this require an astronomer sort of to be looking at the screen and going, oh look, I see a pattern?
Well, that's sort of where it started, and it was realized that this is actually fairly powerful. I mean, you should lose a lot of sensitivity by using these short chunks of data and this incoherent acceleration search, but you get a lot of it back because of the correlations. But yes, there is it is automated, which makes it practical.
Ryan? Just a comment in this area. I'm a bit surprised that radio astronomers have the same sort of fixation on Fourier amplitude spectra as most of my optical variable star colleagues do. But there are, you can do other things. You can do Fourier phase modulation spectra or frequency modulation spectra. And those are designed to find exactly these kind of frequency changes. There's a spectacular example of that done, I suppose, about 25 years ago now, by John Middleditch, looking at Hercules X1 in the optical and doing a complete Fourier spectrum, namely amplitude, phase, and frequency modulation. And the orbital period just pops up immediately. Now, I don't know if you've applied that sort of technique to this, but the advantage is you can use all the data all the time. And in essence, you beat down the noise. You don't take little chunks. So it'd be worth...
I think that's fairly... Yeah, go ahead, Scott.
So I'd like to address that. The way most of my techniques work are exactly that. I do a different type of acceleration search that uses every bit of the phase and amplitude information. And the actual, that other technique I mentioned with the phase modulation, that's the first step in using all of the stuff. So it uses exactly what Middleditch does. The problem is searching blindly using all that information is computationally prohibitive because you don't know anything about the orbits you're looking for. But yes, that is the way to do it, I agree.
There is, of course, an obvious quote-unquote interpretation for why none of these 6624 pulsars have got companions, and that is, of course, it's this extreme core collapse cluster, mm-hmm. and it's disrupted them all, which might have something to do also with the two slow guys, which have been in and out of, you know, a couple of companions. There's this interesting thing that we discussed, you know, I'll mention maybe briefly tomorrow, in 47 Tuck, that if pulsars have been recycled, you wait long enough, they get totally spun up. But if you don't get to wait long enough, of course, as you're saying, they get only partly spun up, then they can get kicked yet again.
Right. I think it'll be interesting when we get a P dot for this last pulsar to see how old it appears to be. Because, you know, time scales are important there. But that's an interesting point. Oops.
I would like to make one more comment about the slow pulsars, which I think is quite interesting for the clusters. And this I don't think has been in any of the literature, and I think people like me are kind of afraid to admit it, but there is a real selection against finding slow pulsars in globular cluster searches. And the main reason is we have these very long integrations, and we get a ton of interference from that. And so interference, terrestrial interference, is predominant at the lower frequencies. And it's very hard to sensitively search at low frequencies. So you see these sensitivity plots like Fernando showed, and they're flat as a pancake out to 10-second periods. Well, I mean, he knows it, and Brian knows it, and I know it. Yeah, we show those plots, but they're bunk. They really are, because out at those far ends, the sensitivities drastically drop because of interference. And so there's probably a lot more of those pulsars out there that we don't know about.
Well, the plots are theoretical in the absence of RFI and receiver temperature fluctuations and things like that.
Even more frightening for the theorists, maybe, this was pointed out, I think, first by probably Dick Manchester. If you do a crude estimate of birth rate, just taking the number observed divided by the age, lifetime, because these quote-unquote young pulsars have, of course, by definition, short lifetimes, if you just take the timing age, you get a huge birth rate. I mean, in terms of processes that form pulsars and clusters, if you want to think about these two classes, this is the one that's largely dominant compared to the one that most of us like to think about.
Fernando showed this sensitivity curve, and most of the pulsars seem to lie below it because of enhancement due to scintillation. So, is that still true with these better search techniques? So that many of the pulsars you find will disappear, like the one when you found, which you're waiting to see again. So.
Yeah.
So is it then hard to get long baseline timing for these things to do?
Oh. For instance, actually, M62F was discovered in the data that was taken to confirm D and E. It wasn't visible in the original search observation that found D and E.
As X-ray people, we were always very impressed by the accuracy of the radio position from the millisecond filters. In that respect, I was impressed that you put the LOMAS X-ray binary at 1920 minus 30. We think that it's off by 1 hour, but that's a detail.
Oh, sorry about that.
Okay, coffee time.